On this episode of the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast.
I love cultivating community. You know, I have a deep, deep network in many different communities. Some of that community over for dinner right after this podcast, right?
A lot of guys are all thinking that every other guy is busy with their family. You know, a lot of times you send a text and be like, yes, exclamation mark, let's do it. Thank you. Enjoy life. You can save your family and build community and not be grasping and rushing and stressing. And so
health, performance, nutrition, longevity, ancestral living, biohacking, and much more. My name is Ben Greenfield. Welcome to the show.
Welcome. What you are about to hear is actually a podcast I recorded with my buddy, Aubrey Marcus, when I was in Austin, Texas. We sat down at his house and had a great and meaningful chat. I think you're going to dig it. Aubrey's a cool guy, and always we have interesting discussions. So the show notes for everything Aubrey and I talk about, you can find at bengreenfieldfitness.com/Ben and Aubrey. BenGreenfieldFitness.com/Ben and Aubrey.
Well, if you're tired of spending hours on cardio with minimal results, then listen up because I got a game-changing fitness breakthrough for you. The Carol Bike, science-backed, time-saving solution trusted by experts for optimizing health and longevity. They use a special form of a workout called a rehit, which allows you to achieve superior health and fitness benefits compared to regular cardio in 90% less time. That's amazing. That's a lot of time, 90%. Studies show that by doing Carol's 5-minute workout just 3 times a week, you can improve your fitness by 12%, reduce your risk of type 2 diabetes by 62%, and even wind back your internal body clock by 10 years. The science is clear. Carol Bike is your ticket to a healthier and more vibrant life. You got to try it to believe it and to see what I'm saying. I mean, it's not like a walk in the park. When you're pushing hard in those intervals, you're pushing, but then it's just like over and it's done and it walks you through it. It's very motivating. It's 5 feet away from me right now. It's right here in my office, my cool little exercise toy in my office. So you get $250 off your Carol Bike. You don't have to wait any longer. You can join over 25,000 riders and visit carolbike.com today. Carolbike.com. Last night, I got my shipment in. That's right. Paleo Valley sent me their fermented meat sticks, which are amazing. They're these beef sticks. I gave a few to some of my friends already, which they love. I actually interviewed Stephen Gundry on my podcast, and he talked about how when you look at a lot of these blue zones, the ones that are the highest ranking in terms of longevity eat meat, but the meat that they eat is actually fermented. And that's exactly what they've done with Paleo Valley. They've actually taken really good grass-fed, grass-finished beef. They've fermented, which naturally introduces gut-friendly probiotics, but more importantly, breaks down a lot of the sugars that would normally cause meat to be harmful, concentrates the vitamins, makes it more digestible, and they have fantastic flavors. They got the original. They've got one that's like a summer sausage. They have a garlic sausage. They have a teriyaki. It's probably my favorite. And you can now get your hands on fermented beef sticks that basically blow that Slim Jim beef jerky out of the water. So check out paleovalley.com/Ben. That's paleovalley.com/Ben to try out these beef sticks and get 15% off your order. Not just beef sticks, fermented beef sticks. Well, if you're like me, you live a busy life. You don't really have time for many days off. That's why I talk so much about your mitochondria, because they generate about 90% of the energy your body uses, and keeping your mitochondria strong is one of the best ways to keep fatigue at bay. But these little mitochondria, darn things, are expensive to run. They use a huge amount of raw materials, especially when it comes to minerals. The problem is most people, including you and me, probably don't get enough minerals. And without minerals, your mitochondria don't have the cofactors they need to make energy. More than 97% of Americans don't get enough potassium. About 80% are deficient in magnesium. 40% are deficient in calcium. And those are three of the big ones. There's close to a dozen other trace minerals that are important for mitochondrial function, and most of us don't get enough of them, and you definitely can't get them from, say, table salt. It turns out that trying to take all the minerals you need by taking single mineral supplements isn't only hard because you need a ton of pills, but it's not the most effective way to get your minerals. That's why I take liquid, humic, and fulvic complexes. These are full spectrum mineral supplements, which means you get all the essential minerals your body needs in one go without a daily handful of massive amounts of pills or very large capsules or anything else that's hard to swallow. I use Beam mineral supplements because they're almost 100% bioavailable. They come in a liquid form that's easy to drink. It's just two bottles. I keep them in my pantry, throw back a shot a few times a day. They're a great way to refill your mineral stores, especially for those of you out here who are haunting your sauna on a frequent basis or sweating or doing hot yoga or anything else. Keep your mitochondria running strong. So if you want to up your mineral game, give Beam Minerals a try. Go to Beam Minerals, B-E-A-M, minerals.com and use code BEN at checkout for 20% off your first order.
That's the way you do it from the get, because I record at my kitchen table sometimes and I just from the get-go, from the start of the podcast, I'll just say, hey, you're going to hear FedEx. You're going to hear UPS. You're going to hear my dogs. You're going to hear my wife and sons coming home from yoga and jiu-jitsu. And just roll with it, folks. You're out in my house. So if you hear the cats.
Well, here we are.
Cats copulating or whatever they're doing back there by the window.
Ben Greenfield.
Yes.
And our cat children. Uh-huh. Well, not our cat children. Not me and you, but me and my wife's.
Yeah.
And they're going fucking wild.
This is purposeful. Do you do this with podcast guests just to kind of get on their nerves, but let the cats unleash
yeah,
in the room.
Yeah, totally. Just let them run wild.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And you practice for years, like meditating with your cats.
Well, you rub yourself with salmon jerky regularly as an emulsifier.
I rub myself with salmon jerky as an emulsifier. I haven't tried salmon jerky yet. I tried coffee, ground coffee. Works pretty well.
Yeah.
Ground coffee has a lot
Unless
of uses.
You're trying to attract bears or cats.
Yeah. Have you ever used ground coffee as a meat rub?
I have.
Pretty good. Yeah. Ground coffee and ground cacao nibs. Like if you do the cacao tea.
Never
stuff,
done cacao nibs.
It's pretty good. A little paprika, a little
Well,
cayenne,
you are now the author of a cookbook. Salt. So, you're kind of an authority on this shit.
Well, no, I wasn't when I decided that I wanted to write a cookbook. I had total imposter syndrome. Then I wrote the cookbook because my wife's a really good cook. Like she's a rancher girl, make everything from scratch. She taught my sons from like the age of four to make souffles and homemade ravioli and risotto. And, and they do meat cooks and roast chicken, everything. And I kind of started to do a little bit of cooking. I don't know, man.
We were in Hawaii. We speared a bunch of fish.
Yeah.
You could cook the little ones.
Right, yeah.
You had to cook the big
ones. Yeah, I did cook the shit out of that parrotfish stuff with the avocado yeah, and the mango, man. And the ground, the what we do, like the mashed taro with coconut oil, macadamia nut. But
and then you would eat those little tiny ones we caught whole.
Yeah, those are good. Like a whole fried, like the one of the few times I'll have fried food is a whole fried fish.
Yeah.
Where you can eat the tail and you can eat the head and like the whole thing's crunchy and fried, kind of like an underground pig roast where the whole thing becomes edible. The ears, the cheeks. Then I just did a 150-pound underground pig roast for my wife's 40th birthday, and oh my goodness, it was absolutely amazing. Not only the meat, the flavor that the meat gets after it steams and cooks for 12 hours under the ground, but just the entire process of digging the pit. And making the fire at 4 a.m. in the morning and burning it down to coals and then getting all these rocks. You don't get rocks from the river because they explode. So we use all these rocks from around
like
the house.
Lodge.
Yeah, exactly. And so you stuff the pig with these rocks after they've heated on the fire for a couple of hours. And then you stuff the pig with banana leaves and you cut little slits all over in it and stuff all that with salt. You rub salt into it. And then it took five of us guys to carry it over into this giant pit that I had dug. We buried the pig, but before you bury it, you cover it with burlap sacks and a canopy and put about 3 gallons of water in there over the fire. And this steam just comes pouring up through the canopy. And then you cover that with dirt and you watch it for like an hour and continue to cover up the steam holes and get it all kind of settled in bed. Then you walk away. And I had a temperature probe in the ass and a temperature probe in the shoulder. And once it hits about 145, that's past raw pork temperature. Mm-hmm. But you want to get up to like 185. So you got like nice crunchy skin and everything's just super cooked. And so we dug up the pig. I had all the dinner guests arriving at 4. We were going to have dinner at 6. And I go out there at like 5:30 and it's about like 139, 140. And, so I had 75 people at the party. So I called a bunch of the guys out. We dug up the pig and we just started cutting slabs off it. And we finished it on the Traeger, which was actually pretty good with a bunch of Hawaiian barbecue sauce. Anyways, back to the cookbook.
When you ate those fish,
yeah,
that was one of those moments where like, it's one of those times where I do a lot of things that are kind of manly. And then there's sometimes I meet somebody and like, oh, well, that's where this person is more manly than me.
A raw fish. We cook them up.
I know, but you ate the whole face.
Yeah.
I don't eat face.
That's where the DHA is.
And the face?
Okay. So that
I just don't eat face.
That entire pig's head is in my freezer. And when I get home, I'm going to bake it with barbecue sauce.
I bet you
sauce.
Are. You're a face-eating son
cheeks,
of a gun.
The
Ben
eyes,
Greenfield.
The nose, the ears. The cats are breaking stuff over here.
Yeah, playing chess.
They're playing chess now. So the cookbook thing, though, I wanted to go ape nuts on molecular gastronomy and like biohacking food and smoothies and cocktails with ketones and sous vide wands and pressure cookers and, you know, and smoking and combining different cooking methods. So that was why I wanted to do the cookbook.
Yeah.
was just put all that together. And what happened was I learned so much along the way that I freaking love to cook now. Like it's up there probably with my top few things to do. Like I play tennis, not baby tennis like you, but real grown man tennis.
I will play you some grown man tennis, you face-eating motherfucker.
Pickle.
Let's go.
Pickle tennis. Pickle. We didn't even name pickle. Pickle, pickle. And then, like hanging out with my sons, playing guitar, sex, and cooking. Like I just
absolutely. Coming from the man who more often than not plays a baby guitar called a ukulele all the time.
Yeah.
Not that I'm shitting on a ukulele. I like myself a ukulele.
Guilty as charged. Ukuleles are up there with pickle for a baby word.
Yeah.
So I put all this together. I did the cookbook, and like at the end of the day, I just love to cook. I mean, the end of the day, every day at our house, at the end of the day, is a party. Like what I mean by that is we don't necessarily have people over, but we gather I can't say the boys anymore. We were talking about this before the podcast. Gather my son. Yeah, they've been through the rite of passage into adolescence, and I'm still working the boys word out of my vernacular, especially when I'm around them.
I think that's really rad, by the way, is just a side note to stay on that tangent is to make it real. Like if you go through a rite of passage, everything shouldn't be the same afterwards. That your tribe, your family, your everybody should respond differently.
Oh, everything that's changes.
Huge.
It's not only do you have a ceremony, you know, like a not just a cutting of the cord ceremony, but they have a giveaway feast where they invite all the family, you know, grandpa and grandma and uncles and aunts and make a giant meal and give away gifts. And there was a ceremonial kind of fire afterwards, actually up at Tim Corcoran's place, a previous podcast guest of yours, who's you know, great wilderness survival instructor and also facilitates rites of passage up there in Idaho. And when they come home, you know, just the vibe is different in terms of the chores that they are expected to do and the amount to which they're expected to pitch in to help with the house, or even something like the family dinners I was talking about where, you know, they're preparing a lot more, expected to do more, you know, prep and cooking and cleanup and chopping and blending and helping dad and mom in the kitchen. Just everything is different in terms of what I expect of them and what they expect of themselves. And, there's more responsibility, but at the end of the day, we all gather and it's like, you know, 7 PM work's done and we make a glorious meal together. We sit and play games for like hour and a half at dinner. We drink wine, we taste olive oil, we try different spices. It's just like this giant
That's
feast.
Awesome, man.
And then we play music, you know, we go up to the bedroom or up to the living room and play music and they bust out the drums and the rattles. And then we go up and we read stories for like a half hour, just everybody laying in bed reading stories. And then we go to bed and every single night's like that. And it's like my carrot on the end of a stick.
Of course, man.
Like when you're working during the day, you know, every night you get this grand party with your family.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's so fun.
That's epic. I mean, I remember we didn't have that much ritual and intention to it with my family, but family dinners, you know, I had three older brothers, three younger sisters, and family dinners were a thing. My mom always would cook and then I would be there. I learned a bit how to cook just because I was always hungry and I was just kind of hanging out, watching her. And I still like to cook, but it's different when it's just now it's just me and Vi, and I'll cook for her sometimes, and I usually cook most of the meals, but it's a different type of thing. You know, it's like kind of like with cooking for two is different than cooking for a family, you know, or cooking for a dinner party or something like that.
It's a lot more chill, you know, because sometimes the boys, my sons, there I go again, have a youth group or have something going on in the evening. And so like every Monday night, my wife, Jessa, and I have Scrabble night. And typically it's like sushi and sashimi, because I get this sashimi grade fish, and I make little poke bowls and sushi rolls and little sushi bites and stuff like that. And we eat sushi and play Scrabble every Monday night for, you know, like a couple hours we'll play sometimes, and then just go head to head on Scrabble. And, you know, the River and Taryn get home and they always want to know who won and how the game went. And sometimes they want us to like leave the game board out so they can see what kind of words we made and how well we played. But it is a different vibe, and there's always that temptation, just let's go out to eat, let's order in from a restaurant. But with the whole family around, it's amazing. And then typically every Saturday or Sunday night, we just have a whole bunch of people over and do the same thing, with the exception being that we do all the sauna and ice beforehand. So I'll pile like 6 to 8 guys in the sauna, and we sit in there while the girls are all upstairs, you know, drinking cocktails or wine and hanging out in the living room. And typically I've got some kind of meat on the smoker, and then, you know, all of us guys shuffle out to the cold pool and do the cold soak. And then we all come inside famished and have this grand feast. And then same thing, we play music afterwards. Sometimes everybody squeezes into the bedroom for story time. And, you know, it's kind of like what we do every night, but we just have a bunch of people over.
Listening to that, right? Like, people probably know you as, you know, fitness, biohacking, human health kind of expert. I mean, you go real, real deep with all that, but there's no greater thing that you can do for the entirety of yourself holistically than the shit you're describing. Of course, you mentioned a few things, hot, cold, blah, 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 but that type of community, that type of family time, the type of fun, the joy, and in that, it supersedes all some kind of extreme tweak on the diet where you're cutting all of this out and eliminating this and doing all this. When you have love and that kind of connection, take that 1,000 times over anything else, right? Like, that's the thing.
We know, for example, one of the longest lived humans on record of late, Jean, I think her last name is Calment from France. Mm-hmm. You know, she lived a very long and happy life. She smoked a cigarette every day. She had a glass or a serving, I think, of scotch or whiskey or something like that. She's getting a little bit of hormesis from her alcohol and her carcinogens. And she was always with people, you know, lots of glorious family hangouts and, you know, people always in the living room. And that was one thing she was known for, was relationships and love and family. And I really did not have a lot of that prior to COVID, because I was traveling. I was on an airplane, you know, every week. I was still racing, you know, doing Spartans and triathlons. So I'd have a race once or twice a month. And I was rarely home to the extent where I felt any urge at all to build community. When I get home, I just want to be by myself or with my family. Mm. You know, I just want to check out and take a breath before the next big trip. Mm-hmm. And when I had, there was a period of time where I had like 9 solid months at home without going anywhere. The incentive to go get to know the neighbors and to build a community and to start throwing dinner parties and to have people over and to get to know my own hometown with all these restaurants and museums and parks and hikes that had been neglecting for like 2 decades. I mean, it's completely changed the dynamic of living in my city and my community. Like I know my neighbors' names, and, you know, rode my bike through the neighborhood several months ago and just dropped off invitations in everybody's mailbox, you know, like a paper boy, and threw this huge neighborhood party and realized I didn't even know like 3/4 of the people who lived within a mile of me, you know, who it turns out they're all like 70 years old. And so it was kind of funny, because we threw this huge neighborhood party and my sons were the only kids there, the only young people there. But still, the idea of community building and actually taking the reins, because you assume that everybody else is like, they know it and they prioritize it and everybody else is out getting to know their neighbors. A lot of people aren't, like, they just don't do that. And so, you know, if everybody were to go out and get to know their neighbors and throw a neighborhood party and have community dinners, whatever, every Saturday night or every Sunday night, and, you know, not only build the family community, but build a local community. I think that's one of the blessings of COVID, actually, is mm-hmm. people actually developing this amazing neighborhood and community. And it's just been, it's been really special for me, and transformative in terms of the joy that you have after 4 hours of hanging out with your neighbors and eating food and making music and chatting. It's far more fulfilling than like whatever meditation, breath work in the sauna by yourself, or any of the workouts or anything like that. Like, it's just so meaningful.
It's interesting to talk about neighbors, because I love cultivating community. Community is, you know, I have a deep, deep network and many different communities. You know, we're having some of that community over for dinner right after this podcast, right? Mm-hmm. And but the idea of the neighborhood, it's always been like a fantasy, but not a reality that I believe in. You know, because I remember in college, you'd go to a dorm room and then all of a sudden, all of the people, and I lived in dorms for 3 years, and you know, little cinder block blocks. But you get to know everybody, and it was amazing. I mean, it's like the least luxurious place I've ever lived in my life, but it was probably the most fun,
right?
Because it was a community. Like when people were ready to hang, you just leave the door open and you just cruise down and be like, "Yo, you want to fucking play NHL 99? Yes, we're in. Like, you want to do this? You want to go, like, you know, beer keg jousting, or like, what do you want to do? Like, let's do something and throw the football, or like chip a golf ball, or go hoop, or whatever else. Like, and you just walk and you're just always around each other. And if you're eating, you don't eat alone. You just kind of cruise around and see who else is in there, cruise in, eat food. And I think so many people are drawn to that again, you know, and it's the idea that you're already there, I think, is a cool idea to explore. And then the other cool idea to explore is like curating that intentionally as well.
It's hard for men, at least I think the majority of men, it becomes harder to make friends. It becomes harder to set your ego and your habits and your safety aside to actually have other guys over and, you know, have them into your domain and begin to branch out. And, you know, now, you know, I'm playing frisbee golf and paddle boarding and playing tennis and shooting hoops in the driveway and having guys over in the sauna and having these dinners where they're coming over with their families. And it's really cool because, you know, up until that point, I thought I had a lot of guy friends because I'm part of all these mastermind groups. Whenever I travel, you know, there's all these folks I'm hanging out with, but it's different when it's at home. And these are all people who just live a couple miles from you.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
You know, my neighborhood's different. We're out in the middle of the forest. You know, really a neighbor is somebody who's like a mile and a half away minimum. But I didn't really realize the absence of strong, close, geographically meaning male friends in my life until I really started branching out like that. And now it's just cool at the end of the day to know that you can pick up the phone or text somebody and have, you know, somebody meeting you at the river with the paddleboard like an hour later. And a lot of times you think, oh, they're busy, they're with their family, they're doing their own thing. But a lot of guys are all thinking that every other guy is busy with their family. You don't want to bug, but you know, a lot of times you send a text and be like, yes, ! Let's do it. Thank you. Totally. And then afterwards, everybody, you know, they'll text you and say, oh, thank you for doing that. I needed to get away. You know, and it's just, it's really cool to be able
for
to
me,
that.
It's one of the things that's really necessary for me to bond with men is doing something that allows like that initial bridge to be made, you know, so that can be pickleball. That could be basketball. Mm-hmm. You know, I made a really good new friend recently. And it was just like, you know, met him. Oh yeah. You know, you play pickleball. I play pickleball. And then I always look at him like, do you really play pickleball? Yeah. Whatever. Yeah. I was like, all right, we'll give it a go.
Visiting Instagram, looking through his story and his videos. Where's the shot of this guy playing? I got to stalk him.
But
for
he
a little
comes
while.
Over and he, you know, plays a good game and then we start talking in between games as other people are playing. And then, but that thing of like competing together is a real key part of kind of branching out. So there's like the basketball squad, now the pickleball squad, and then there's a shooting squad and the tactical shooting squad, and then there's the, you know, the on it squad, the on it workout squad. There's all of these different groups, and we have a men's group, and it's pretty fucking cool to feel that starting to come together in all those ways. But for those people listening, and just from my own advice, and maybe you're like me, if you're a guy, like an activity, building it around that activity has been the thing that makes it so much easier.
For men especially, and I read this in a book recently. I don't recall the name of the book, but men form friendships around activities. And women often form friendships in just like a social gathering setting, you know, not necessarily playing pickup basketball or pickleball or frisbee or whatever, but just, you know, sitting around at a restaurant or in a living room or whatever the case may be. Men tend to form close friendships and bonding friendships around either doing hard things or doing adventures or just going out and playing together.
Yeah.
And it's kind of funny because that happens to me sometimes. Like I'll invite somebody out for frisbee golf, right? And the nature of frisbee golf is such that you don't do a lot of talking. Like, you're off in two different directions throwing your frisbee. You meet up at the hole and you chat, and then you throw again and off you go. But there's like this invisible bond that gets formed as you're just doing that same thing together, that that I think men especially tend to develop good friendships around.
And for women, I think that that is something that it's not like it's not available there, but maybe the inclination isn't, I don't know. I think, I feel like it's a, it's almost like a technology for community building that is underutilized by women. And it's not, because it's not that it doesn't work, because it absolutely does, but it's just, I think it's using the same kind of ideas to get around that. Because what I've seen a lot of times is women will kind of hang on, like hang on to friends, like a lot, like friends that, because it's not activity based, it's like, oh, I'm going to go see so-and-so, but they're not really excited to see so-and-so. It's just like, they've seen so-and-so for 20 years. They're totally different people now, but this is like a habitual thing. But because there's no activity that keeps it fresh and makes it like, all right, this is something interesting that we're doing. And if you can't keep up, well, you, you know, might not get invited to that activity. We'll find something else, but it keeps this thing like a river that's just, the water is circulating, or a healthy pond where there's always fresh water going in.
And let's face it, like, women in general are just naturally, for the most part, stronger social creatures.
Yeah.
Right? They, I don't think they need as much built-in technology trickery as us guys do to make friends. Like, my wife, you know, just walking to a party and have like six friends, you know, and I'll be standing there in the corner waiting for somebody to throw me a football or something so I can make a friend, you know?
Yeah, that's very fair.
Yeah.
community being probably the most important thing that we have. And we've talked about a lot of the other simple stuff. When you start to analyze someone, like, let's say you go in blank slate, you're looking at somebody and you start addressing, you know, some of the other big things that you see people missing that you find really valuable. Things that aren't inherently obvious, but where do you start? Where do you start looking?
I think that one thing that you and I both know a lot about that you can identify pretty quickly in someone is their connectivity to breath. Like, just the way that someone is breathing, you know, watching everything from nasal breathing to how they breathe in response to stress, to how they carry their breath when they're exercising or when they're speaking with you. That's one thing that I think should be built into the core educational curriculum of every young human on the face of the planet, is the ability to be able to have an intimate understanding of the best dial that we have built into our physiology for amping up or amping down our nervous system. And so I think that breath and relationship with one's own breath is one thing that I think it's something that says a lot about a person, just how they breathe. So that'd be one that I think a
everybody
lot of people are missing out
breathing
on.
Breathing way better right now after.
Yeah, that. Yeah. They're like, people are now judging me based on how I'm breathing.
Yeah, for sure.
Got to make sure my belly button's visibly moving through my shirt now. I think that there are certain core practices, again, apart from exercise or biohacking or eating healthy, that are just built into my core now. For example, like our morning and evening meditations that we do as a family, like, they're something that we now all do when we're traveling, when we're apart, we hold each other accountable. We gather every single morning on the porch, and typically, you know, these days I get up about 3:45 or 4 a.m. and I work for like 3 or 4 hours, not just work, but I do all my stretching and having my coffee and doing my red light and sometimes hitting the sauna or doing the cold pool. And, you know, I like to have a lot of my day done now by about 8 a.m. But around 7:30, in terms of having like eaten the frog and gotten my body ready and feel like if nothing else happens that's productive, the whole rest of the day, I've actually made a really good dent in things. Mm. And I always just thought it was absolutely crazy when I would see guys like, you know, Jocko or whatever, you know, show their 4 a.m., you know, clock. And I had lots of fears about that. Like, I'm going to be tired in the afternoon. I'm not going to be able to make love with my wife because we're on different schedules now and she likes to sleep till 7 and I'm in bed now at like 9 and we're like ships passing in the night, and you know, that didn't happen. The afternoon tiredness I found is easily solved. Like, even if you're sleeping 6 hours with like 10 to 30 minutes of a really good nap, it seems to replace, you know, a good 90 minute sleep cycle. Yep. And once I found that out, it was like 1 to 2 extra hours every single day.
That's the biggest thing for me. And that was, I think you might've turned me onto his book, Nick Littlehale's book, which then guided a lot of those principles.
Yeah. And a lot of people know about Nick. They talk more about Matthew Walker or Michael Bruce or,
I love Nick's philosophy. Yeah. I really feel it, like somatically feel it to be true, mm-hmm. that 20 to 30 minute nap, mm-hmm. is just as good as an extra an hour and a half of sleep.
Yeah. Yeah. And it can be, you know, something like Dr. Andrew Huberman talks about, like a yoga nidra cycle. I like to use the non-sleep deep rest protocol. I like to use the new calm. Like, that's mm-hmm. typically what I'll do. And yeah, I'll put on like some kind of device to shift me into that state even more quickly, like an Apollo, for the vibration therapy,
yeah, or just
like
Dr. Dave Rabin on.
The HAPB is another one I really like. It'll simulate.
Just got
like
that one. Haven't tried it yet.
Theobromine or caffeine or MDMA or like CBD or melatonin or adenosine. Like, it'll just simulate any of those. And I like the.
No way.
I like the CBD.
I gotta put that HAPB.
Yeah, that's what they do. And they just added theobromine. I didn't even try it.
So
yet.
You plug in MDMA protocol.
Yeah. Yeah, that'd be like the I forget which one. I think that might be the social one. There's another one that's alcohol. Yeah. I put it on my son Taryn one night at dinner just to see, and he got all like loopy and goofy. And when I put the alcohol one on, the best way I can describe it is that I feel like I've had like 3 cocktails when I've had like half a glass of wine.
Well, if you're tired of spending hours on cardio with minimal results, then listen up, because I got a game-changing fitness breakthrough for you. The Carol Bike, science-backed, time-saving solution trusted by experts for optimizing health and longevity. They use a special form of a workout called a rehit, which allows you to achieve superior health and fitness benefits compared to regular cardio in 90% less time. That's amazing. That's a lot of time, 90%. Studies show that by doing Carol's 5-minute workout just 3 times a week, you can improve your fitness by 12%, reduce your risk of type 2 diabetes by 62%, and even wind back your internal body clock by 10 years. The science is clear. Carol Bike is your ticket to a healthier and more vibrant life. You got to try it to believe it and to see what I'm saying. I mean, it's not like a walk in the park. When you're pushing hard in those intervals, you're pushing, but then it's just like over and it's done and it walks you through it. It's very motivating. It's 5 feet away from me right now. It's right here in my office, my cool little exercise toy in my office. So you get $250 off your Carol Bike. You don't have to wait any longer. You can join over 25,000 riders and visit carolbike.com today. carolbike.com. Last night, I got my shipment in. That's right. Paleo Valley sent me their fermented meat sticks, which are amazing. They're these beef sticks. I gave a few to some of my friends already, which they love. I actually interviewed Stephen Gundry on my podcast, and he talked about how when you look at a lot of these blue zones, the ones that are the highest ranking in terms of longevity eat meat, but the meat that they eat is actually fermented. And that's exactly what they've done with Paleo Valley. They've actually taken really good grass-fed, grass-finished beef. They've fermented, which naturally introduces gut-friendly probiotics, but more importantly, breaks down a lot of the sugars that would normally cause meat to be harmful, concentrates the vitamins, makes it more digestible, and they have fantastic flavors. They got the original. They've got one that's like a summer sausage. They have a garlic sausage. They have a teriyaki. It's probably my favorite. And you can now get your hands on fermented beef sticks that basically blow that Slim Jim beef jerky out of the water. So check out paleovalley.com/Ben. That's paleovalley.com/Ben to try out these beef sticks and get 15% off your order. Not just beef sticks, fermented beef sticks. Well, if you're like me, you live a busy life. You don't really have time for many days off. That's why I talk so much about your mitochondria, because they generate about 90% of the energy your body uses, and keeping your mitochondria strong is It's one of the best ways to keep fatigue at bay. But these little mitochondria, darn things, are expensive to run. They use a huge amount of raw materials, especially when it comes to minerals. The problem is most people, including you and me, probably don't get enough minerals. And without minerals, your mitochondria don't have the cofactors they need to make energy. More than 97% of Americans don't get enough potassium. About 80% are deficient in magnesium. 40% are deficient in calcium. And those are three of the big ones. There's close to a dozen other trace minerals that are important for mitochondrial function, and most of us don't get enough of them, and you definitely can't get them from, say, table salt. It turns out that trying to take all the minerals you need by taking single mineral supplements isn't only hard because you need a ton of pills, but it's not the most effective way to get your minerals. That's why I take liquid, humic, and fulvic complexes. These are full spectrum mineral supplements, which means you get all the essential minerals your body needs in one go without a daily handful of massive amounts of pills or very large capsules or anything else that's hard to swallow. I use Beam mineral supplements because they're almost 100% bioavailable. They come in a liquid form that's easy to drink. Just two bottles. I keep them in my pantry. Throw back a shot a few times a day. They're a great way to refill your mineral stores, especially for those of you out here who are haunting your sauna on a frequent basis or sweating or doing hot yoga or anything else. Keep your mitochondria running strong. So if you want to up your mineral game, give Beam Minerals a try. Go to Beam Minerals, B-E-A-M, minerals.com and use code BEN at checkout for 20% off your first order.
So wait, how does this thing work? It's like a halo that goes around your head.
Exactly. It goes around your head or around your neck. It's a magnetic signal that's imprinted with the same frequency as whatever molecule that they're trying to simulate. And it causes the same electrical reaction within the cell. But the cool thing is, as soon as you flip it off, that molecule is no longer hanging around in your bloodstream.
Right.
Right. So I can have it on caffeine. As soon as I turn it off, it's not as though I'm up for 4 hours with disrupted sleep. It's like as soon as you turn it off, the alertness goes away.
So how do you measure the frequency of a chemical like MDMA or alcohol?
Giant underground silo built deep within the ground, protected from all other frequencies that you then isolate that molecule in and measure the magnetic frequency. And the reason this sounds silly is because it sounds like I'm kidding. And then I talk to their scientist who does all this, and that's basically what they have.
Whoa, I thought and they've you like, were like talking
licensed,
about
no, they've shit. Licensed this technology from some FDA, you know, medically cleared wearable that was originally designed for something like epileptic seizures or something like that. I forget, but they've done that same thing. And I didn't really believe it until I started to use it. And it actually works remarkably well. Yeah. But anyways, I put the CBD on for the nap, and back to the reason that I do that is because about 7:30 after I've kind of done all my morning stuff, I gather the family on the porch and we all sit cross-legged in the sunshine, or if it's the winter, we're in the living room by the fireplace, and we basically all have a journal and we close our eyes for 1 minute and just connect to our body, just breathe and connect to our body. And then I have this little ding that goes on the Insight Timer app on my phone. I just have it programmed for 7 minutes. So after the first minute, then it dings. And for the next 2 minutes, all we do is gratitude. And we have our journal there that we can stop to write what it is we're grateful for about. But those 2 minutes, just all gratitude, breathing the gratitude into your heart center and writing down what it is you're grateful for. And then the next 2 minutes are dwelling upon who it is you want to send positive emotions to that day, who you want to pray for, who you want to serve, who you want to help, and you write down that one person and you're just on them with laser focus the entire day, whether it be just positive emotions you send their way, whether it's prayers, whether it's phone call, text, if they're someone local, you know, doing something nice for them, you know, whether it's delivering dinner or just going up and knocking on their door, seeing if they need help with anything. And then the final 2 minutes are just reconnecting to self. And then we finish with tapping. So when we're in that state at the very end of the 7 minutes, we'll tap over our heart center, over our wrist, to create an anchor for that same feeling of peace that we developed after those 7 minutes that we can then return to during times of stress the rest of the day with that anchor that we've set just by tapping in that same location. And so we then all get up and we do a giant family hug together and just hold each other for like a minute after we've done that meditation.
So the whole thing is 8 minutes long.
It lasts about seven. Well, with the hug and everything, yeah, it's about 8 minutes. Mm-hmm. And then I'll just ask, you know, about everybody's day, you know, and that takes like 2 minutes. Okay, what's everybody doing today? You know, where are you going to be here? Where are you going to be here? And that way we can plan like when's dinner going to start, when we're all going to meet. And then everybody's just like off to the races the rest of the day. And I work from home, so we see each other and right. you know, we cross paths throughout the day. And then at the end of the evening, like right before we go to bed, we return back to those journals. We all close our eyes. We do in the morning, it's like a six count in, six count out breath work. Mm-hmm. In the evening, we go with a longer exhale. We'll do like a 4-8 breath work. You close your eyes and you watch yourself like a movie character through the whole day. Like, how did I wake up? What did I do? What did I read in the morning? How did I spend my morning? What did I have for breakfast? What did I do between breakfast and lunch? What did I eat for lunch? You know, how did I spend my afternoon? How did I spend my evening? And the entire time you're watching yourself like a movie character in your mind in the third person, you're asking yourself, what good did I do this day? Meaning, what was I proud of that character about? Where was I rooting for them? Where did I know that they were making the right decision? What could I have done better this day? I mean, where did that character fail? Where do I feel like they were more the villain than the hero? Where was I not rooting for them? Where do I wish I could have like leapt through that screen and told them to make a different decision? That's not the right decision. And as we're visualizing that, you have permission to like take pauses and write down in your journal what you're discovering. And then finally, the last question we write down in the journals is, where is I most connected to my life's purpose? Where is I most purpose filled today? Because what happens is sequentially, as you go through that every single day, you not only identify, even if you don't have a purpose statement, even though you know we all do, and I think it's important, you can almost like reverse engineer your purpose statement when you're doing this practice by identifying as you go through, okay, this is where I was in the zone, smile on my face. Time was flying by, you know, as though I had no awareness of time. I felt as though this was coming easy to me. I felt like I was using a unique skill set I was born with or doing something I was really good at when I was a kid, something that makes me happy and fills me with joy now. But you write down what it was that was the most purpose-filled activity of your day. And it stacks because, you know, if there's something you failed at, like for me, I was writing down for like a week, didn't play my guitar today, didn't play my, like my manly guitar, not my pickle ukulele, but the full on big boy guitar.
I got
through like a week of that. And like for a while we would share, like we would actually say, what good did I do? But we decided to start keeping it private. And if you want to share, you can,
yeah.
But it actually not only kind of, well,
it might make it performative almost to a certain
extent. You think about it, you think about what I'm going to, and sometimes it'll be something super embarrassing. You just don't want to share it. Like you just want to keep it to yourself and dwell with that and work on it yourself. But one night, this was like 3 months ago, we finished it all up and then afterwards we'll say a prayer and then we all just go to bed. Like that's after story time, that's after dinner, that's after everything. And I finished writing. I'm like, I am never going to write this down again. For the past week, I've written that I wanted. So now, like, even if it's just 2 minutes, right? Even if it's one song, even if it's like the G, D, C, easiest song on the face of the planet, I take out my guitar and I at least strum it. So I never have to be watching that movie character in my mind, wondering why they're not doing that one thing they know brings them joy. They know they love, they know just connects them to the frequency of music and the joy that they get from it. But they're skipping it every day, right? And so these things stack. Or, you know, I was most purpose-filled when I was writing today. I was most purpose-filled when I was writing today. I was most purpose-filled when I was writing today. Oh, hell, maybe God made me to be an author. Mm. Maybe that's actually, you know, something that I'm going to be happy doing until I'm 90.
Or at least for now.
Right, exactly. Like this is the chapter in my life where that's what I need to be doing because that's what was most purpose-filled. So back to your question, you know, I think that that's another thing in addition to community building and breath work, this idea of beginning your day and ending your day, bookending the day with a practice like that, that is palatable in terms of time investments where you're going to keep doing it every day, mm-hmm. you know, because I tried like TM, you know, the 2 times 20 minutes a day. I just like can't do it. But 7 minutes in the morning, you know, 4 to 5 minutes in the evening with the family, you know, and having that accountability with the family and knowing that even, you know, the young men in our house, you know, they can handle that and they can sit with that amount of time. It's pretty meaningful. So that's another big win for us.
Yeah. Really listening to you say that. I mean, there's truly no reason. It's the cost benefit of what you just described is so wildly in favor of doing it.
Yeah.
Like there's very few things that I've ever heard that have a more favorable cost benefit than what you just described.
Right. And you know, it's a win too, because there's a lot of stuff that, noodles I've thrown at the wall to see if they stick for home practices, you know, like whether or not we would share what we'd written in our journals, or the amount of, because we all, you know, read scripture every morning, like how much are you going to read? Like, is it a section? Is it a chapter? Is it a verse? What I've discovered is that, for example, with the journaling practice, I do it when I travel, whether or not any family's around or not, right? Because it's something that just freaking works. That's one metric for me, is if I keep doing it, even when nobody's around and, you know, nobody's watching, you know, it's something that I know is really valuable.
Yeah.
So
when you have a lot of these possibilities, a lot of these interests, a lot of these different things, and giving yourself permission to, and actually structuring how you allot time to all of these various things, this is something that, you know, I personally find challenging, because I have so many things that I love to do, and I have so many things that I can be productive in, and so many things, like if I have an extra hour, how I spend that hour could be so many different options that I could, offer. I could create something, some piece of content. I could write, I could, you know, mastermind this new product that we're coming out with, or I could practice pool, or I could play, you know, play music, or I could learn how to DJ, which I'm endeavoring to do. But there's so many fucking things that it's like, I'll do something, but everything feels like it's on such a long loop that sometimes it'll be like, fuck, it's been 25 days since I played my flute, but I have been doing other stuff, but I feel like it's preventing me from real progress in anything.
It feels like horizontal shallow living because of the number of opportunities that are presented as a result of the connectivity that we have that enables us to dip our toes into just about any hobby or interest or book or food or skill on the face of the planet that for thousands of years, we just never would have known about. Like, we wouldn't have known that the sport of underwater torpedo existed.
Dude, underwater torpedo league. Are you in one?
No, I haven't played yet. No, I'm up in Washington State, and it's not California, but yeah, it's on my radar. Or the 10 packages that show up at lunchtime every day at my house, right before I'm about to take my relaxing lunch. And it's like three devices that I have to plug in and figure out and download the app for. And I feel guilty if it sits in the corner neglected, because I know I have to get to it someday, because it's part of my quote job unquote to test these things out and let the world know about whether the magnetic device that they hide underneath the solo or the silo deep in the underground works or not. And then there's like the two different musical instruments, the banjo and the little miniature hammer dulcimer and the tiny didgeridoo box so you can learn circular breathing, but really, you know, you'd be happy with just the guitar. And so it's hard also when you are in the position of being an influencer who's highly accessible by all these companies who are exposing you to lots of things.
Companies and
plus
people.
Plus all the things that everybody else gets exposed to just on social media and the internet in terms of cool new things to learn and to do, and the FOMO that you get with that. And so what's really helped me out with that, in addition to just knowing what really satisfies your purpose in life and actually analyzing that at the end of the day and playing your day like a movie in your mind to see what minutes and what hours were wasted on things that maybe weren't that fulfilling, is the idea, which I suppose I would say is more of a belief, that I am going to live forever. I'm going to live forever. And I believe that there will be a new heaven and a new earth, and that heaven is not going to be a bunch of us sitting on a cloud, on a fluffy white cloud with angel wings, like bored out of our minds playing a harp or some shit, right? or neither do I think that heaven is going to be some amazing, blissed out, DMT-infused journey where you're just floating and you have that sensation of you don't have a care in the world. And your body is just laid out on one giant blanket with colors going through your head, and you feel as though you could just lay there forever. And as anybody who's gone through any type of significant journey has experienced that one spot during a journey where you're just like, I could be here forever.
Whoa.
This is amazing. I could just live with this forever. Pure peace. Just leave me here. Just leave all these molecules in my bloodstream. I'm good. I'm not guilty about not accomplishing anything in life. This is just a perfect place. I don't think heaven will be like that either. I think that heaven will just be exactly earth as it is now, but perfect, where we can still create and we can still build and we can still draw and color and take baths and play music and make love and be with our pets and do everything that I really think that we are intended to do in the first place, but in a pure and clean and toxin-free and sin-free environment where everything's just perfect. And so because of that, when an opportunity gets presented to me or a new skill or a new instrument or watercolor versus oil versus scratchboard versus sculpting versus glass blowing, I think to myself, you know what? I have infinity. I have infinity to be able to do any of this stuff because I think that that's what heaven's going to be like. And I realize not everybody believes that, but dude, like once that kind of like light bulb went on in my head, like that whole idea of just being guilty about not doing all the things just vanished.
That's huge. I mean, obviously I have a different religious ideology and cosmology than you do, but
which is why I'm going to behead you after this podcast. Take your bones home to my family. I'm gonna paint a little mark on my chest of another one.
I'm your Huckleberry. Let's go. You will play big tennis and then Highlander. Mm-hmm. There can be only one afterwards. But first, we play big tennis. But ultimately, the idea that. Because there is some value to the Stoic belief, memento mori, remember you're going to die, because it gives prescience to the preciousness of the moments we have. But it can also, if you twist it just slightly off and miss the point, it can put you in a rush. Mm-hmm. You know, and I feel that myself. Like I'm in a hurry way too much. Mm-hmm. But when you're talking, you know, the idea of like live like you're going to live forever, there's something like my whole body just went, ah, yeah, that feels good.
Right.
And like, that feels really good.
Let's say you're not going to live forever. Or let's say it's mental trickery. It's pretty damn good mental trickery.
And it
works. And, you know, you do have to, as you've just alluded to, strike a balance. Like that doesn't mean you lay in a hammock all day because you're going to live forever. So what does it matter? I mean, there's a great book called Don't Waste Your Life by an author I really like named John Piper. And he gets into this idea, like he never wants to be like, you know, 70 years old with his wife driving golf carts around a beach and, you know, fishing for hours on end. Like he wants to help people and love others. And like, I think about it this way, like if you were going to, let's just play the game. Like if you were going to live forever and if you knew that you were going to experience like immense joy and the ability to do, you know, anything and everything pleasurable on a perfect earth for the rest of all time.
I don't even need a fucking perfect earth. I'll take this earth. This earth is pretty rad.
Yeah, this earth is amazing. But
and, you know, and I think almost this is a choice to make it at least close to heaven.
Yeah.
You know, like we have that choice available.
Yeah, we and my belief is that the world's getting better. Like I don't believe in the, you know, coming apocalypse or anything. I think the world is getting better and better. We've got speed bumps along the way, but I'm actually what technically you'd call me a post-millennial Christian. And what that means is that I believe that all the talk in the Bible about, you know, in Revelations about, you know, dragons and apocalypse and, you know, people think this is the Chinese black helicopters and the beast is Bill Gates and whatever. I believe all that was just prophesying the destruction of the holy city of Jerusalem, and that everything you read about is just that took place like between about 60 and 80 AD. And that from that point on, the world gets better and better and better, and we're not going to hell in a handbasket. And yeah, we have little things that happen along the way, but my belief is this earth is just gradually becoming more and more perfect. And so I have a very positive mindset when it comes to that. But you know, back to that mind game, if you did believe that you were going to live forever and it was going to be that good, and you did have all this time on your hands, what would be the number one thing that you would do? And the conclusion that I've come to is the number one thing that you would do is you would go tell everybody, hey, look, you're going to live forever. You guys, like, you can slow down. You can enjoy life. You can save your family and build community and not be grasping and rushing and stressing. And so basically that comes down to some semblance of the golden rule, right? If you were going to live forever, what's the number one thing you would do? You would love others, right? Because by loving others, you're spreading that wealth, you're spreading that message. And so I think
that. And love the earth too, because right. obviously, like, if we make a hell out of our environment.
By loving the earth, you are loving others. And that's definitely not, I mean, that's another thing that I'm not ashamed of when it comes to being a Christian, but it's certainly something that I think is sad, this idea of what is called in Christianity the dominion mandate. God made the planet and handed over to human beings and told them, take dominion over this earth, it is yours. And so we build factories and we, you know, strip oil from the ground and we overfish and we in some cases overhunt and you know, we eat Doritos and Cheetos and monocropped soy and weed at the church potlucks and the dominion mandate was a call to be a gardener, to care tenderly for this planet that right. we've been placed upon, and to foster, you know, animal husbandry and taking care of the soil and learning all the plants and knowing the sacred intelligence of all the herbs and growing things that were placed around us. And instead, you know, this like post Reformation scientism, logic, rationalism-based Christianity has resulted in the complete loss of a connection to the sacred intelligence of the planet and caring for it. Because, you know, God forbid we be all woo-woo like the pagan shamans and be, mm-hmm. you know, whatever, you know, talking to vines. And so, yeah, there's this total disconnect that I think is kind of sad to a certain extent, because we live in a magical world.
And a conversation like this is probably helping push that evolution. The thing is that people think because the Bible is fixed and no new passages are there that a religion like Christianity isn't evolving. Well, bullshit. I mean, look at the Christianity of the 1700s, 1600s, yeah. or 1400s Inquisition. Look at it now. Look at it from the 80s when people were yeah. still promoting hellfire and brimstone and gays were all going to hell. And now you look yeah. at that and like the whole thing is evolving. It is far more living than people realize. And that gives me actually a lot of, I like that. I like when things are like flexible and things can be replenished and refreshed with, you know, and reevaluated.
Even something as simple as plant medicines, which are often vilified, especially in Christianity, because they are considered to be the equivalent of a lack of sobriety, of drunkenness, which is warned against in the Bible for what I think would be sound societal reasons, right? You don't want a bunch of drunk people walking the streets, throwing bottles at windows and getting in fights and, you know, whatever. Like, that makes sense, right? It's just built in societal stability. But when you go back and you look at even something like the Bible and you look at two different forms of cinnamon, Ceylon and cassia, you know, Asian cinnamon that technically are acting as cytochrome enzyme inhibitors and allowing for other molecules to stay active in the bloodstream for longer periods of time. And those are combined with, for example, myrrh and frankincense and even some forms of cannabis. And there's actually a tree that's very much like ayahuasca. And I'm acacia? Blanking on the title. Yes. The acacia tree. There's lots of examples, especially among early Jewish practices, of these type of things being used. You know, we read about in the Song of Solomon, these crazy mixes that when you look at them and you analyze them chemically are technically very strong aphrodisiacs. Or you look
Have
at,
you ever tried to make one?
No, I haven't. It's actually on my list of things to do. I'm gonna live forever. Now I vaporize sometimes organic tobacco with a little bit of cannabis with essential oils like blue lotus or nutmeg or myrrh or frankincense. I haven't done the exact recipes that are in the Bible yet, because there's two different things
the Bible bag recipe.
I'm going to live forever. And trust me,
Bible bag volcano night.
I have an Evernote document that's full of things to make, things to do and things. And that's both these are on the anointing oil and the incense used, you know, in early tabernacle worship. You know, if you look at the ingredient list of those, you're looking at a bunch of cytochrome enzyme inhibitors and topical ingredients that, when applied transdermally, it basically allows any molecule that is co-ingested or co-applied along with it to stay active in the bloodstream for a longer period of time.
So almost like an MAOI.
Similar concept as a monoamine oxidase inhibitor, uh-huh. Right? Very, very similar concept. Same enzyme pathways, everything. But when you look at, for example, the anointing oil of myrrh and frankincense and cinnamon and cannabis and these different extracts that were applied as an ointment, and then you look at what was burnt as an incense, again, frankincense, myrrh, cannabis, things that would arguably be considered psychoactive substances that were burned in essentially like a four-layer thick, small room, you know, this tiny called the Holy of Holies, you know, inside the tabernacle, which, you know, not to blaspheme or make this sound the wrong way, but essentially almost like a tiny hot box to a certain extent. And, you know, and the priest literally like had a chain around his ankles. People could track, you know, whether or not he'd passed out in there from this heavy incense in the air that was a highly psychedelic substance. And, you know, and to be able to intentionally interact with the divine in that environment, and for the exact instructions and recipes for those to be given out in the Bible. And then for guys like, you know, Brian Marascu, who wrote the Immortality Key recently, you know, showed that very similar entheogens may have been used in things like the Eucharist, you know, in terms of the spices that were mixed with the wines. And he has a massive book about that. When you put all this together, what you come down to is the fact that to disconnect ourselves, especially in Christianity, from that sacred intelligence and from those type of blends that were used to enhance a spiritual experience or to connect more deeply with the divine. You know, I think it's a little bit sad, and I in no way would argue that therefore these type of things should be unleashed upon the planet, and everybody, you know, at church on Sunday morning should be drinking a, you know, Eucharist based wine spiced with frankincense and myrrh and cannabis, because I also believe that certain people are called and certain people are not.
Sure.
Right. The role of a priest or a shaman or anyone in that position traditionally has typically been to go to that place on behalf of the people and to come back like an oracle.
Depends on the culture. Like, yeah, one of the cultures that I'm very familiar with, which was Don Howard's lineage, was Chavin. Mm-hmm. And so the priests in Chavin would offer Huachuma, which eventually the church renamed San Pedro because it was the gateway to heaven, you know, so that's why they call it San Pedro cactus, right? It's incredibly hard open, mescaline derived experience. But in Chavin, which flourished for about 800 years, and during that 800 years is marked by the fact that there was no sign of warfare amongst neighboring tribes and communities. One of the reasons why is they would offer Huachuma to all pilgrims who came through, didn't have to pay for it, whatever. They often brought gifts, but they would just offer Huachuma to anyone who wanted to come. Big, massive ceremonies of Huachuma. And that medicine in particular, I think, is well-suited for that. And obviously, I'm sure they had a great technology about how to manage such a situation. But then they also had Vilca, which is a combination of 5-MeO-DMT and N-DMT and bufotenine, and they didn't give that to everybody. That was just for the priests down in the catacombs in the black, and they would snort that, and that was their medicine, and then they offered it for everybody. So there's so many different ways to look at this, and I'm not saying that, you know, I think any medicine on the substance should be for everybody.
Like henbane, for example, right, which is very similar to like what the Viking berserkers would use. That's another molecule that you can find in ayahuasca. I mean, if you look at the flower
on like a
Levite priest's headdress, it's the henbane flower. Right? It's not Anamita, but that molecule is found in ayahuasca. I don't know if it's found in Anamita. I don't know if there's henbane in Anamita or not. But is that nicotine, by the way, that you just popped?
It is. You want some?
I have a piece of nicotine gum in my pocket, and I'm just going to pop that right now.
Yeah, let's go.
I mean, if we're both going to be on the same substance here. but an example of what you've just alluded to would be like manna that came down from heaven, right? Which most likely was an ergo-based fungus that very similar to a lysergamide, technically more like an LSA than an LSD, but a fungus-like substance that falls from heaven that spoils overnight, that must be therefore baked and cooked and prepared properly. But, you know, it's very, very likely that's what manna was, you know, and so technically you would have all the Israelites wandering around the desert who actually had this total, you know, feel good chemical from ergo, from manna in their bloodstream. And then that would be an example. And, you know, at the risk of you know, 8,000 pastors calling down hellfire and brimstone on me for blaspheming right now. I'm not saying that there is concrete evidence that the Israelites were wandering around the desert on LSD. But what I am saying is that there is a great deal of evidence that plant medicines in many different formats were an enormous part of the entire Judeo-Christian religion. Sure. That I think that that post-Reformation scientism and radical logical thought and this idea of pure sobriety has kind of beaten out of us, and I think that there are more cons to that than pros.
I almost a lot of people who've had issues with addiction in their family or mm-hmm. something, they will equate doing plant medicine with drunkenness, mm-hmm. Or addiction. Mm-hmm. And, I think in my conversations with Luke Story, who came from that, and when I met him, he was in his sobriety for 15 years or something mm-hmm. like that. And classic sobriety, AA sobriety, nothing on nothing. The conversations that we've had in my own experience, even though I've never had addiction issues, but a lot of times these medicines are what Don Howard would call clarogens. And it almost creates a hyper sobriety in which mm-hmm. on them, you're more sober than you are in your daily life when you're addicted to your drama. Right. You're addicted to your own thought patterns. You're addicted to the conditioning of the world around you and all of these other endogenous chemicals that are keeping you locked in a certain prison of perception. And all of a sudden you break free and you're like, oh shit, I'm awake and aware for the first time.
It's not an escape. It's an altered, elevated state of consciousness.
Correct.
which many people who have not been in that state simply do not understand. And they say, well, that's just like you had, two bottles of wine, and it's nothing, nothing at all like that. It's like your brain has become a 20X supercomputer with merging of the left and right hemispheric activity and the ability to be able to creatively solve problems or to have an enhanced spiritual experience. And so, yeah, it's entirely different, but back to the Bible, there's firm instructions in that book that say, if this is causing your brother or sister to stumble, just leave it at the door when you're hanging out with them, right? Like if wine is something that someone has a previous history of abuse with or addiction to, or their parents were alcoholics, or there's some sort of negative association for them with it that would make it very uncomfortable for them or tempting for them or problematic for them if you were to consume that in your presence, and that could be meat, it could be vegetables, it could be plant medicines, it could be wine, best to just leave it alone, which I think is sound advice. So you do need to be careful about someone's previous history and their association, but
and people can abuse plant medicines, and people, I've even seen one example at least of someone who is using ayahuasca as an escape, and mm-hmm. then ultimately that's not the use for it, and that takes the roots that come from the feet of being on the earth and sweating and mm-hmm. living normal life, and he just kind of went off into the air for quite a while, right. And that's like the risk of using these things as an escapism. So a lot of it is intention. Absolutely, for sure.
But and it's the fruits too. The fruits that it produces are right. pretty self-explanatory. And if someone has massively transformed their relationships in a very positive way and their life and their productivity and their clarity and their vision and their purpose, those are pretty darn good fruits,
yep.
in my opinion. And
isn't there a saying like you will know them by their fruits?
You will know them by their fruits. In many cases, Jesus in the Bible, he would actually curse a tree that had bad fruits, that had a bad vine that didn't produce. There's even a book, and I think it's called The Vine, that gets into this, like just this idea of stepping back and analyzing. And this is another reason I like that evening process of self-examination, analyzing which activities are producing which fruits. So that you're aware. And yeah, you can certainly tell back to the abuse of plant medicines, how, when they're producing good fruits in someone and when they're not. I think that's something else to pay a lot of attention to for anything in life. Really.
I just had a really powerful sober encounter with at least maybe it was perhaps my own imagination of Christ. Perhaps it was Christ. I always say whatever, if I encounter an entity, a being, mm-hmm. I leave it to, it might be my own projection of them or whatever, mm-hmm. but I was going through and I was tapping into, a lot of my own you know, fear about certain things in life and my stress. The fear is always behind the stress, you know, and where that was coming from and what I'm afraid of. And there was also shame in associated with that fear, and fear of fully stepping into my purpose in life, fully accepting what I believe I'm here to do. And there was the shame about stepping into it, and there's a fear of what might happen. I was being kind of facilitated by a great kind of body worker who guides you through this meditation. And I think she helped open that conduit, but Jesus came through and I was in this, and she really encouraged me to go into that fear and go into that shame and really feel it and then get help. And Jesus, you know, is kind of who I called and who came to help. And Jesus came in the most loving way, and he saw me in my fear, and he saw me in my shame, and he just looked at me and he says, "Me too." Mm-hmm. And that was one of the most profound moments that I've had. And again, this is sober, but it was this beautiful thing of, I think we sometimes think of Jesus as only the perfect being, not ever having had, you know, these doubts, these fears, this not feeling pain, just being unbelievably courageous throughout the, but when he looked and said, "Yeah, me too," I was like, "Oh man, yeah. Thank God." You know, like, yeah. "Oh wow, you too? All right, I guess I'm doing okay."
Me too. Like a freaking deity who had to take on like a broken human fleshly body and have to like be born and shit his diaper and get zits and you know, and get cuts and scars and have to, you know, work all day in the hot weather, you know, as a carpenter. And then eventually, you know, got the worst curse ever imaginable, like nailed to a tree, right? Tortured, beaten. And then at that point, like basically none of the pain or the shame had even started, because then like he had to take on all the shame and sin and suffering that anybody ever had experienced, for all like the Holocaust and Genghis Khan and World War One, World War Two, and every rape and every murder. Like he had to live through all of that in order to actually take on the sin of the world. So when you saw Jesus and Jesus said, "Me too," I mean, he really, really meant it. Like there is nothing shameful or horrific or painful that has happened to anyone, like the deepest, most shameful thing, that he did not experience himself. And that's why you can actually like leave all that shame behind, is mm-hmm. because he took on all of that. So yeah, the Me Too isn't just like, yeah, I, you know, whatever. I, you know, I got cut up too and fell and bruised my knee when I was a kid. And, you know, I had to deal with peer pressure. No, it's like every last torture that you can ever imagine, every last piece of flesh being ripped off your body, like all of that.
Yeah. And I had also, you know, in the meditation, he gave me a cross, and on the cross was inscribed "Me too" as like a reminder. It was like something, because there was a message like, I need to remember this. So when I get lost in my own, you know, self-reproach, my own self-judgment, to remember, like, you know, as all of us, because if you embrace the totality of everything, you know, like Christ consciousness is, it's the all, it's the divine. And of course I'm putting in some of my own beliefs in here. We'd have slightly different beliefs, but
that's why we're going to battle after this.
Yeah. That's why we Highlander when we're done. But fundamentally, and then I understood, and that was like a beautiful reminder to me, like, all right, me too. And so it removed all that judgment, but then the cross itself, you know, was a really powerful symbol that I haven't really connected with, because I've almost taken it as just a signifier of your belief in Christianity. But, you know, I understood that there was that moment before, you know, when he knew he was going to be crucified and he still said yes, you know, but he was going through it that night. I mean, you read about it, "God, why have you forsaken me?" Right. Mm-hmm. There was this like feeling of abandonment. Like, right. why is right. this my path?
What crying the bloody tears. Yeah.
Right. Like, but he still said yes. And there was this amazing courage. And so to me, that cross was like reframed in my own mind, at least, is like, holy shit, that is a fucking symbol of ultimate courage to say yes to no matter what life throws at you.
Right.
And just be like, okay.
Is a symbol of courage. And up to a certain point was, it would basically be, if you were to get a cross tattooed on you, the equivalent of getting like an electric chair or a noose tattooed on you. It's like, why the hell would you do that? Like, it's a freaking curse. It's a sign of murder. It's a sign of death. And not only that, a sign of like the worst death that, that the worst criminal would be given. Like even, I believe it was Cicero who wrote how it was the most horrific death imaginable, like a crucifixion. Why would anybody want to get something like that tattooed or like put on the door of a church or something like that? But now it no longer means that. Now it means victory. Now it means courage. Now it means, you know, complete setting aside of shame. Now it means a, you know, a new heaven and a new earth. And it's like the, this symbol that went from being a curse to being a blessing, that went from being the most horrific thing imaginable to being the most glorious promise available. And so, yeah, like, the cross is something different now than I think it was before Jesus. And yeah, I think it's a super powerful symbol now.
Yeah. You know, as we go through this conversation though, we're starting to make the a lot of different categories of things that once they're fulfilled, you'd live this rich, rich life. I mean, we've talked about community and we've talked about these meditative practices and connection to nature and then the rituals, the rites of passage that your children run through, the, you know, then everything that you're about, but then also this kind of belief and this deep belief that you have. And everybody's belief doesn't have to be the same, but really walking the walk of that belief, not just kind of intellectually kind of believing it, but like really living in your belief. And that's deeply fulfilling. And then having your belief and then your purpose and then everything woven together and guiding principles like live like you're going to live forever. You've painted this beautiful picture in this show of really kind of a formula for living a life that's as rich as can possibly be lived and giving the opportunity to turn this life into heaven. You know, I was on Tim Ferriss's show and he said, if you're going to make a billboard, you know, and put one thing onto the billboard, what would it be? And I was like, well, it'd be welcome to heaven, population, everyone, you know, like here we are, everybody, like, here we got it. Mm-hmm. Are we going to make it that or are we not? You know, this is a choice we have.
Right. And it does really come back down to that foundational principle that was pretty much the essence of Jesus. And that was love other people. Just love other people. Like, and it sounds so simple, but once you start to frame everything that you do in the day, including the way that you build your business, right? Like, how many lives are you going to touch? How many people are you going to love? You know, at the end of the day, the budget does have to be attended to, but will take care of itself. If the bottom line is how many people can we reach? How many people can we help? How many people can we love? And it's the same with our personal lives too. Like just this idea of not living selfishly, not grasping at straws because you have that confidence that you're going to live forever. And then knowing that with that life, like the very best thing you can do is just go out and love other people. And loving other people means loving the planet. It means loving God. It means loving yourself. Right. But it's all
because
framed.
The lines are a lot more blurry between all those things. When we try to pretend, we think, oh, this is me and this is my house. And then this is my neighbors and my, it's like we make separations between this or my mind and my body and my spirit. Everything is so much more blurry than we realize. Right. Like we're interacting with each other's field constantly. And that which we cast aside and cast judgment on, it cannot escape from casting judgment upon ourselves because we're connected. That thing that we do that's bad to somebody else, that hurts somebody else, hurts us, even if we pretend that it doesn't. You know, this is the unblinding when we really start to see that.
Right. And you know, one thing, I guess this would be my last comment on the living forever part is, you know, many people will say, well, Jesus was like, you know, Mother Teresa, right? To a certain extent, like you just live in poverty, you know, like he said to the rich young ruler in the Bible, just leave everything and follow me. So are we supposed to just like forsake our houses, forsake our wealth, forsake our families, forsake our nice clothes and just like waltz off into the sunset in the desert in our sandals to go out and just serve other people the rest of our lives? But that is, I think, almost like a guilt-producing version of Christianity, and in some cases other religions, this idea that therefore our best calling is to forsake everything, including ourselves, our wealth, our success, to serve and love other people. I think there's certain people that are certainly called to that, but when I ask myself, like, dude, like, so if there's a divine being and a God, and I believe that there is, and he made us, and I believe that he did, why'd he make us? Like, why'd he just like throw this rock down here with a bunch of greenery and an ocean and a moon and a sun and some stars and then throw a bunch of people on it? And it's because, you know, if I'm at home and I have this, you know, home that I've built and this property that I've created and this life that I've given to my sons and my wife, and I look out my office window and I see them like playing cornhole in the backyard and eating a popsicle, and my wife sitting there in the hammock and drinking a glass of wine and maybe scrolling through some cool stuff on this magical little box, you know, that's got an Instagram on it. And, you know, it's actually kind of a cool creation. And then the sun's shining and the grass is green. And I look out at all that and like, I'm super proud and really happy about what I made for my family, right? Like, this is really cool. I could just stand here and take immense joy out of just seeing them savor this tiny creation that I've helped to build, right? And when I think about God, you know, he makes this magical planet that we kind of fucked up a little bit, but hopefully we're going to get on track. Mm-hmm. And I think that we are on track. You know, it's this amazing creation that he made just because it's pleasurable to watch all this cool thing, all these human beings and, you know, these people and life and the breath of life. And now they're enjoying all this stuff and the amazing steaks and food and wine and pickleball and ukulele and sitting around and talking and hearing the sound frequency of each other's voices. And after this, our taste buds will be entertained with some amazing food and then we'll sleep in bliss and have crazy dreams and visions and wake up and have an adventure. Like, that brings a lot of joy to the creator. And so I also describe myself as basically like a hedonistic Christian in the fact that I believe that one of the things that we can do that makes God the happiest is to savor his creation and actually like own nice things and drive a cool car fast in the highway and have a comfortable house. And yes, like don't live so far beyond your means that you aren't able to love others and still have that philosophy and that approach to spreading the wealth and loving other people. But don't forget to like savor God's creation too. Like, we do kind of live in a fun little, you know, or big, you know, circle.
Yeah.
And it's nice to also be able to savor that. So I think that you need some amount of balance between, you know, loving others, loving yourself, savoring God's creation, but also sacrificing yourself to others. And I think it's a balancing act, but
yeah, it's a balance between working to save the world and savor the world.
Yep.
You know, like, exactly. Don't get lost like on either side.
Save the world and savor the world. Yep. Yeah. That's a perfect way to put it.
We've been talking about living forever, and you actually, you know, probably know a lot about the different longevity practices, technology, and you've probably talked to a lot of people, a lot more people than I have. And I know there's some people who make this their life work to figure out how to extend human life. If you were going to actually, you know, from put on your scientific hat, not your religious hat, and say like, all right, how long? There it is.
Flip it around.
There it is. How long is a human being going to live? Like, and at what point do we have to get to like arrive healthy to this start point to where we get to be 150 or we get to be 200?
Right. Well, we know based on current epidemiological data and the extent to which people have lengthen their lifespans in like the past 2 to 3 decades, we've gone from like, you know, 115 to like 117, 121 tops. And we've kind of like leveled out, right? We're not going much longer than about 115 to 121 right now. Now, there are a lot of people walking the face of the planet right now. And many people have predicted that the first person who's ever going to live to 150 in a long time is already alive. And that's based on medical care. That's based on technology, everything from, you know, hyperbaric oxygen therapy to NAD, to stem cell therapy, to, you know, all of these things that are the longevity hacks that people are doing now. So theoretically, we could be extending lifespan, but from yeast to rodents to fruit flies, like, there's not a lot of evidence that we can appreciably increase far past like about 121 where we're at right now. Mm-hmm. Like I would be pleased if I live to 120 plus, but realistically, like it would be pretty shocking if people started living like much longer than 115 to 121 years mm-hmm. old. But there's a capability built into mammals and even humans. You know, if you look at the bowhead whale or the naked mole rat, everything from carbon dioxide tolerance to the ability to be able to repair damaged proteins and DNA, that there are built-in repair mechanisms that could technically allow us to go for a longer period of time. And when you look at like whatever, you know, Methuselah in the Bible, or, you know, some of these genealogies that go way back, people living 800, 900, you know, years old. You also have to take into account, and there's a wonderful book I'm reading right now just about, you know, this tale of a massive flood where all the waters fell from heaven, and nearly every culture on the face of the planet has this story of some massive flood that occurs that wipes out everything and changes the Earth's atmosphere. Well, if there was a covering of water above the planet that had changed the gases and the atmospheric pressure and a lot of things that can influence longevity and carbon dioxide in the bloodstream and the nutrient density of plants and many other factors, and that all fell from the sky and flooded the planet and completely changed some of those gases and the atmospheric pressure and just the way that the Earth operates, that the lifespan that people were able to have prior to that event is probably no longer realistic. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's the case, but I really would be surprised if in the next few years we're seeing anything much longer than like about 121 or so.
Yeah.
Just based on everything
that's, you know, there are those people out there that are like, look, if you can make it relatively healthy another 10, 15 mm-hmm. years, you got a good shot at 150. You know, right. what is the argument that they're trying to make, you know, that you think that makes that make sense?
That when you stack a lot of these hacks that theoretically you could repair DNA at a fast enough rate, you could stave off immune system degradation at a fast enough rate, you could stave off, you know, the natural mutations that are built into us, you know, again, from a DNA repair standpoint at a mm-hmm. fast enough rate, and you can, you know, build up carbon dioxide tolerance and you can repair tissue more quickly and things like hyperbaric chambers and use red light therapy and all these things, that when you stack all of that theoretically you could increase lifespan.
Yeah.
But it's all just like on paper right now. Like I haven't seen any hard evidence that that's actually possible. Yeah. I mean, like some rodents, for example, they're showing like a 20 to 30% increase in lifespan, but these are like highly controlled laboratory environments with specially, you know, bred rats and mice. And like there's a lot of confounding variables yeah. when it comes to humans, but you know, does it matter? Like I don't think
ultimately
it
hasn't. Like, and that's why I haven't invited, you know, these particular guys on my show who
right.
are really proposing that, because I'm, you know, I get in there in the 90s. Fuck, I'm stoked.
Yeah.
You know, that's a long ass right. life.
If,
you know,
if you're making maximum, like for me, it's about impact. It's not about
totally.
Like if I can make if I can increase my health span to the point where the impact I'm making with whatever lifespan that I'm genetically programmed to have approximately, you know, I'm super happy with that. So it's just about taking care of your body so that you can make the biggest impact that you can
and
with the life that you've
been
given.
And enjoy it for the longest.
Right. Exactly. So I think we've even had this discussion before. I don't want to be one of those guys who's cold and hungry and libidoless and lives an extra, you know, let's say I live an extra 30 years, but I'm spending 20 of those extra 30 years, you know, in a hyperbaric chamber or a cold tank or fasting, or, you know, reducing my ejaculation frequency or anything else that we know could potentially help out a little bit with longevity. Like you got to draw the line at some point. And so, yeah, I think that especially in the health world, there are people who are kind of returning back to your idea a little while ago, like how do I choose between all these activities? They're fritting away a lot of time, just trying to live a long time
when
they could just be out enjoying life and loving other people.
You talk about ejaculation frequency. I heard something from Kyle that was talking about how every time you ejaculate, you're depleting magnesium and zinc through your ejaculate.
Not very much. I don't know if you've seen the size of ejaculate. Like I just did my daddy kit recently to kind of like store my sperm and just check up on what the count is and everything. I mean, you know, so I of course got to witness that. And the amount of minerals I'm depleting, I would imagine that by me putting some sea salt on my steak tonight and taking a little zinc tomorrow morning,
yeah,
that's easily like one load right there. So yeah, it's that whole concept is more about like your jing, your qi, your life force. It's more about that than nutrients or minerals, because yeah, your body does not go through, I would say, anything more than like a very, very small meal in terms of the amount of nutrients and minerals necessary to make semen
good
or sperm. So yeah,
coming every day, then that's fine. I'm back to it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's this whole idea of giving your energy away. And I get the whole concept, but the concept is not one of nutrient or mineral depletion.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. Ben, this is a beautiful conversation, man.
And that was a great thing to end on too. Like, how much sea salt do you need to make enough sperm?
Yeah,
and you know, at what point do your adrenal glands just not have enough to go around? And you're going to be out playing pickleball out there and you're going to cramp. And you'll be like, oh, shit, I came last night. I didn't take my sea salt this morning. Uh-huh. I'm sorry, guys. I got to go in the house.
Yeah. That's right. I mean, we gotta keep it real for people.
That's right.
Talk about all different things for your health, for your heart.
Savor the world. And feed your semen.
#feed your semen.
That's right.
Yeah, tadpoles need to eat.
That's right, baby.
Tadpoles got to eat.
That's right.
Anything you got going on you want to tell people about?
You know what? We kind of did when we were talking about the cookbook.
Yeah.
Because I think it hits Amazon like this week. And yeah, it's got some tasty shit in there. So
it's dope. Yeah. I've enjoyed cruising through it.
Yeah.
Beautiful, man.
Cool.
Great to have you, brother. Thanks everybody for tuning in. Peace.
Well, thanks for listening to today's show. You can grab all the show notes, the resources, pretty much everything that I mentioned over at BenGreenfieldFitness.com, along with plenty of other goodies from me, including the highly helpful Ben Recommends page, which is a list of pretty much everything that I've ever recommended for hormones, sleep, digestion, fat loss, performance, and plenty more. Please also know that all the links, all the promo codes that I mentioned during this and every episode help to make this podcast happen and to generate income that enables me to keep bringing you this content every single week. So when you listen in, be sure to use the links in the show notes, use the promo codes that I generate, because that helps to float this thing and keep it coming to you each and every week.